Welcome to Coin Flips and Controversies, an OrthoBullets original series dedicated to exploring gray zone decisions in orthopedic surgery.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the OrthoBullets Coin Flips Controversies. I'm John Barlow, your host from Mayo Clinic, and this post is being sponsored by the Mayo Clinic Comprehensive Shoulder and Elbow Course. It's held in Scottsdale each year. This year, January 25th to 27th of 2024. We think it's going to be a great time to get together and discuss shoulder and elbow controversies, and we'll discuss this case among many others. Today, I'm joined by several esteemed guests. I've got my partner, Sean O'Driscoll, who goes without introduction, but has a long career of treating distal humerus fractures and discussing and writing about distal humerus fractures. I've got Jenny Tank Depaibuntana. She's one of my new trauma partners at Mayo Clinic. She's dual trained in trauma surgery at Harborview and shoulder and elbow surgery with us at Mayo Clinic. So she'll bring a little bit of insight from each of those realms. And I've got Jan Szczepkowski, who trained with us at Mayo Clinic, did Campbell Clinic trauma fellowship, and is now at Indiana. He's the director of trauma. So we hope to bring some different perspectives on this difficult case. Thanks each of you for joining. Today, I'd like to discuss this case, which we posted. It's a 73-year-old patient who suffered a ground level fall. At the time of the fall, she was living independently. She denied any antecedent elbow pain. At the time of the fall, her past medical history was significant for hypertension and atrial fibrillation. She's on anticoagulation, but otherwise reasonably healthy. I would consider her an indoor, mostly person, but she's reasonably active, knitting, crocheting, and other activities like that. On physical exam, she has a BMI of 48, and examination of the elbow shows swelling of the elbow, intact skin, and without abrasions, no evidence of open fracture, no tricks here, trauma-trained people. She's unable to flex and extend the elbow secondary to pain, and she has no deficits distal to the elbow. Her vascular exam is normal. Certainly, we want to focus on ulnar nerve here. So let's start with Dr. Tank Depaibuntana. And we've got x-rays, an AP, and a lateral of her elbow. Tell me what you're looking at on these patients, and especially in the early evaluation and workup of this patient. What are you looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I think here is, you know, an attempt at an AP, probably, you know, looks a little bit flexed, but, you know, there is a fracture primarily along the lateral, you know, part of the elbow, so probably involving some part of the capitellum, but otherwise, the other things I'm looking for is, you know, is there any dislocation of the radiocapitellar joint or the ulnar humeral joint that might require a closed reduction attempt in the emergency department. Other things I'm looking for, I think it's pretty easy to zone in on, you know, the obvious thing that's broken, but looking for other associated injuries, right? So soft tissue swelling, is there subcutaneous air tracking? Could this be an occult open fracture? I know it was closed, but then also, you know, making sure you get complete imaging. So including a lateral view of the elbow and potentially an image of the joint above and below. And then on clinical evaluation, just, you know, making sure you're asking your residents or you yourself are examining, you know, the shoulder and the wrist to make sure you're not missing any other injuries. On the lateral here, I think it's maybe a little bit more apparent. You see in our articular fracture that's pretty displaced proximally. And then, you know, certainly some other areas of comminution that's a little bit hard to discern, you know, where it's coming from, but otherwise the joint itself looks grossly reduced.
Jan, what do you think here? You see lots of these complex traumas. Any additional thoughts about these x-rays and what you'd be thinking in this patient?
Echo mostly what was already said, but I think one of the things that concerns me is her, you know, her BMI is 48. So I think that plays a more, you know, adds a more of a challenge to this injury and case and evaluation. The one thing I do notice, if you go back to the lateral view, is the displacement of a couple of the fragments proximally. it just tells me that there may be more energy associated with this. And that's what I'm kind of, you know, concerned about, not only the bony injury here, but the soft tissue injury as well. If any of the ligamentous structures around the elbow have been damaged, because that's very significant displacement to see when the rest of the distal humerus looks more or less in the correct neighborhood.
Sean, how about you? Any additional thoughts that you would add, things that you pick up on and pattern recognition here?
Yeah, great. Thanks, John. Great points already made. I'll just go to what hasn't yet been said, or at least I didn't pick up on. A couple of things. One is that the fragmentation on this AP view, the fragmentation laterally tells us that these fragments are quite thin. They also go right up into the area of the tendon origin and the ligament origin. So this elbow is going to have substantial potential to be unstable when all is said and done. So having said that, let's look now over here at the medial side. And on the medial side, I'm going to annotate again here. We can see a couple of things. The slope of this trochlea right here is abnormal. The perpendicular to that, if you look at it, is pointing up in this direction instead of up in this vertical direction. And what that means is that the lateral part over here has been impacted, lateral part of the trochlea has been impacted up into the humerus or onto the humerus, you might say. So on this lateral view, we see a couple of things. One is that the radial head is quite a bit higher than the ulna. And that means that the ulna has been rotated up on the lateral side. And that rotation upwards on the lateral side is indicative of, if we go back to the AP, is indicative of that sloping trochlea. See, the trochlea is kind of rotated up this way like that. And that swings the radial head proximally. That impaction is key in a fracture like this, because that's going to have to be disimpacted. And the disimpaction is going to leave a void. And that void in a 73-year-old woman with comminuted bone over here and multi-fragmentation and the origin of the collateral ligament and the tendon being off and a large arm means that this is going to be a challenge post-op to manage. So while I would propose normally to fix every fracture that can be fixed, I suspect that this one may be just a little bit over the line in the sand for that.
No doubt. It was one of the parts of this case that I thought was really important to notice is it would be easy to misconstrue this for a capitellar shear fracture and treat it as such, in which case I think you'll have sort of an expected poor outcome because of lack of understanding of this impaction of that lateral aspect of the trochlea. So thanks for pointing that out so clearly. And certainly you can already see some subluxation at that of the elbow joint. So I totally agree. We always get CT scans and we basically always get three-dimensional reconstructions. Jan, is that standard of practice for you in your practice? Do you oftentimes do? Another thing that I know is common in some trauma programs is traction views. Is that something that you like to use for these type of fractures or what's your approach with these?
Yeah, so I think, yeah, for me, all these get CT scans with 3D recons. In terms of the traction view, I think that's ideally that'd be great to have, I think, in some cases, but I think that's not necessarily always the nicest option for the patients. But I think, you know, that could be helpful in the OR or if they have another injury that, you know, many times some of these patients are polytrauma patients. So I'm fixing their femur. So then I'll do it like an intra-op traction view. But I don't get traction views routinely, like in the ER or anything like that.
I know Sean's going to criticize me, but Jenny, tell me, these views are not perfect. Certainly we'd like to get a better CT with the arm above the head. And then we'd like to get a three-dimensional reconstruction of this patient. And in particular, we'd like to do that with subtraction of the ulna and radius. I don't have those images today, so we're a little bit limited. But Jenny, thoughts or change in your idea about this fracture as we go through things or additional imaging you need to be able to make decisions about this patient?
Yeah, I think, you know, Dr. O'Driscoll was very keen on picking up, you know, some of the subtle injuries on X-ray alone. I admit that I'm still fairly reliant on the CT scan to provide me some of those details, in hindsight now are a little bit more obvious on X-ray now that they're pointed out. But yeah, certainly, I mean, the trochlea looks to be at least in two pieces. That capitellar component, which appears to be perhaps attached to the lateral epicondyle, does appear to be quite thin. So I don't think from a surgical management, or, you know, assuming this patient is an operative candidate, I don't need any additional information. You know, I don't find MRIs to be that helpful in trauma, in the acute trauma setting. Traction views, I think, for this type of injury are probably not that useful. I think they're more useful in maybe distal humerus fractures if you're trying to decide preoperatively whether or not you need to go straight to an olecranon osteotomy versus, you know, maybe an attempt a paratricipital approach. I mean, I think a lot of this will be meeting the patient, learning, you know, who she is as a person, discussing some of her goals and figuring out what would be the best option for her.
Perfect. One thing on the imaging that I want to point out, you know, Dr. Tengtapai Buntani, you said you probably can't pick up the pattern quite as quickly as Sean. One of the things we talk about a lot, and I would encourage residents and even faculty who are doing these to think about, I think Sean will echo this. I'd like to hear his thoughts. But one of the really helpful, some people would say, well, I know what I'm going to do based on the X-ray, and therefore I don't need a CT scan. But taking the X-ray, going to the CT scan, taking the three-dimensional CTs, looking through those, and then going to the 2D, and then going back to the X-ray and looking at what those fracture characteristics look like helps you as you get additional X-rays. And that's sort of building that wisdom over time, which is why Sean can break these down so nicely. So I think sometimes we say, well, it doesn't change my management, but it certainly is adding to your wisdom about these cases over time. Sean, any additional thoughts? I know you've thought a lot about imaging. Certainly you've taught us how to read three-dimensional and two-dimensional CTs. Any thoughts about that kind of philosophy, getting CT scans on these patients?
Oh, I couldn't agree more, John. To me, that's a non-decision. A CT scan should be done in every one of these. If you get to the point of expertise, where you are truly an expert and an authority in the field, and you come to believe that in a particular case, there is nothing to be added, well, that's perhaps, you know, for you to decide that. But it would be, I think, it would not be wisdom to teach people that a CT scan is not necessary. So I would say that a CT scan is very, very, very appropriate in these cases for many reasons. One is that you can't know all the details until you see the CT scan. You can reason what those details probably look like with reasonable assuredness once you've had enough experience seeing them. But then again, you can't just suddenly become a chess master either. You know, you take some time to develop those pattern recognition elements and so on. So yes, I would still get a CT in every single patient. And what you just said, John, about the backwards forwards benefit of that is huge. So my ability to understand what's going on, like that image that's right in front of us there, that sloped trochlea and the olecranon being over laterally on there, that's something I recognize because I've looked at CT scans and I then came to recognize the impaction of the trochlea and the tilting of it. In retrospect, I could then see it on an X-ray, which is why today I'm seeing this for the first time. I don't know anything about the case. That's why I can recognize it on the X-ray because I had the opportunity in the past to work backwards from the CT scans. So yes, John, very wisely said.
Perfect. Team, we're going to go to some questions. Anything else that you need to see on imaging before we go to some questions, put screws to it in terms of making decisions? Or do you feel pretty confident here? All right, we'll go to some of the poll questions. So this is something we sort of talked about, what additional imaging studies. And I think for us, in essentially all cases, we really rely heavily on a CT scan. I don't think, for me, an MRI allows a substantial amount of increased knowledge. You can see there's a subset of surgeons who would be okay with the X-rays. But I think each of us, even with my low-resolution CT that I showed, gained a little more insight into this fracture and fracture pattern with the CT scan. I'm not sure MRI has a substantial role. There's some discussion about the role of ligament injury in some of these patients, But I think certainly the bony anatomy is going to be for sure the most important part there. So I think we'll go on to the next question after that, because I think we all agree we wanted a CT scan. Next question, I think all of us believed operative indications were most reasonable. And I think the most important thing for us, as we talked about it, was that early subluxation, that tendency for subluxation or dislocation, as a not pertaining to this case, but just as a curiosity. Jan, in a given year, how many distal humerus fractures will you treat non-surgically? I will occasionally, I'd say one or two times per year, have a low non-displaced, low supracondylar fracture that I can treat non-surgically. But for the most part, displaced distal humerus fractures require an operation. How about in your practice?
I would agree. It's very rare. I think most of these, you know, to get the patients moving again and so forth, I think, I'm kind of surprised about how much you can, you know, actually fix and how well they do. Obviously, there's complications that can arise, but you really, for a lot of these patients to get back to their activities of daily living, many times operative treatment is warranted.
Perfect. Any additional thoughts on that, Jenny? You're probably similar practice, only rarely non-operatively managed. I think it's different than in kids, and you typically have to get these articular segments fixed rigidly to ensure a good outcome. Any other thoughts about that?
No, I mean, I think in very, very rare exceptions, there's one patient recently who I considered non-operative treatment only because she had a very large gouty tophus mass that I didn't want to cut through. So I discussed, you know, the options with her, but she ultimately didn't like the idea of being immobilized and fixed her. And I actually just saw her today and she's actually doing quite well. And thus far, you know, no wound complications. But yeah, I think I have I tend to be fairly aggressive with these just to get them moving.
That's great. All right, let's stay with you, Jenny. If you choose surgical management, which you did, how would you treat this patient? X-fix, closed reduction, percutaneous pinning, open reduction, internal fixation, or arthroplasty?
I pick six to be funny. No, just kidding. I think this is where I'm torn because, you know, I think I typically wear my trauma hat more than I wear my shoulder elbow hat. And so if I can't fix a fracture, then I feel like it's a failure on my skill set. But that being said, I think honestly, I think critically evaluating her CT scan, you know, her age, the amount of impaction, the amount of pieces, realistically, I might be able to obtain a reduction, but I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to maintain it. So I'd be concerned that whatever I do, regardless of my skill set, that it may not be a durable option. So I certainly would maybe lean towards arthroplasty, but I think it would be one that I would, you know, churn for a while and go back and forth.
So I'm going to help you churn a little bit. So the articular segments are small, but they're very distal. So that sort of leans you more toward total elbow arthroplasty, the size of those and the amount of bone on each of those fragments. Is that true?
That's true. Yeah. Yes.
The size of her arm gives you pause about that, makes you lean in toward open reduction, internal fixation. Is that also true? I'm now just leading the witness as you
can. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, if you think about, you know, risks of complications that come with total elbow arthroplasty, right? You know, I'd be worried about, you know, wound healing complications, infections, and, you know, kind of opening that pathway for that patient. So I don't know that her size, I guess I would say her size probably would lean me more towards fixing, understanding that certainly in the rehab process, she'd be putting a lot of varus stress across that fixation. You know, so then I would spend a lot of time really trying to counsel her on how to protect that.
Activity level would be the other one. Is that the other sort of indication for you to go one way or the other?
Yeah, potentially.
Eyeball test of what she looks like and what she thinks she's going to want to do with her elbow.
Yeah, potentially. You know, I think what I learned from Dr. O'Driscoll, and I don't want to speak on his behalf, but I think the common question that comes up with arthroplasty is like this 5 to 10 pound weightlifting restriction, and you know, how, and then often, you know, shies people away from offering that option. But I think what I've taken away is, you know, most patients, you know, will do things with their arthroplasty regardless of what you tell them. And so a lot of it is guidance. I think a common question maybe in someone who's 73 is, well, can I carry my 15-pound grandchild? You know, and I think the answer is, well, if it brings you joy and you need to, then sure. And if things come up, then, you know, we'll deal with it. So it's more of a practical conversation. But yeah, but if she's super active and still plays sports, then, you know, maybe I'd consider ORAF. But yeah.
So you say arthroplasty. I'm pinning you down, Jenny. Arthroplasty?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Yes.
Jan, how about you?
I don't know. After this whole discussion, I kind of just want to refer it up to the Mayo Clinic again. That's option number 7.
So. Yeah, that's right.
Or if Driscoll's looking for another job down here, so.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, for me, like, you know, arthroplasty is not in my wheelhouse. I do run these cases by one of our shoulder elbow surgeons who does do total elbow arthroplasty. So, and, you know, he's of the mindset, basically, I think Dr. Driscoll said the same thing, you know, try to fix most of these. And that's what we try to do. We're very aggressive in fixing these. I don't think this would be easy. I think, you know, looking at that shell of bone, you know, anteriorly, but, you know, this is something I would fix. I still pause at her soft tissue status because I think, you know, I think that's really got to discuss with the patient the potential rate of complications no matter what procedure is going to be done. But this would be, for me, this is going to be fixed, you know, not, you know, but I think, you know, replacement, you know, looking at now a little bit more at that impaction, especially as medially, you know, I think that'd be reasonable. But once again, you know, if you're thinking about a weight pound, you know, 5-10 pound weight pound restriction, every time this patient even moves out of bed and gets up, that weight is being met and then some. So I think that's something that needs to be considered here.
Yeah, no doubt. A paper that we recently published demonstrated that there was not a tremendous cost to well done fixation of distal humerus fractures if revised to total elbow. So it's not like it's free. Certainly it's an operation for an elderly patient. There's a possibility of infection, nerve injury, otherwise. But in most cases, they could be salvaged with the total elbow arthroplasty. Sean, any additional thoughts about what would you do with this patient?
Well, it's been well said already. If I were treating the patient, I would plan on doing a replacement. And it's not very common that I would plan to replace rather than fix. I've even been in the situation with somebody a decade older than this where I planned on replacing it, opened the elbow up and looked at it and said to the person scrubbed with me, yeah, I mean, this, you know, we could probably fix this, but it'd be better to replace it, only to learn that the prosthesis and the instruments were at the other hospital. So I said, looked at him back again. I said, well, I guess we're going to fix it. And it did fine. It did fine, but it was at the extreme level of challenge for fixation. I think there are two factors here that would help with decision-making for anyone watching and listening to this. One would be, what is your level of experience with fixation of these really complicated fractures? These, I believe, are generally fixable by somebody with tremendous experience and understanding with them. But they are beyond the ability for most to fix a fracture like this, I think, and have it work out well. The second would be, as Jan had said, if fixation maybe is thought not to be possible, what's your experience with replacement? And then what's the bailout if you get in there and try to fix it and can't? So I think having a clear plan as to what the backup will be, and if you go to fix it, knowing exactly what your backup plan is really, really important. I think that either approach to this fracture is a very defendable approach, quite frankly.
I think that's totally true. And I think the first step, which each of us has commented on, is the recognition of the complexity of this fracture. And I don't think a surgeon should feel at all bad about putting them in a well-padded splint and referring them to an expert, because this is a difficult case regardless. The only thing that I would comment, I put up the poll for everyone to see, and I think ORIF is a good idea in arthroplasty. I think closed reduction percutaneous pinning would not be advisable here. And certainly in certain cases, I've seen where people try to do damage control or otherwise with this technique. And I would not advocate for that. So I think you have to get rigid fixation of those articular segments or do a well done arthroplasty. And I would avoid closed reduction percutaneous pinning. So let's go into the details a little bit more about this. So if you are going to do open reduction internal fixation, Jan, you are the most thoughtful and wanted to do fixation. What's your approach for fixation and how are you going to get there and how are you going to repair this?
Yeah, so, you know, I go posterior, go paraolecranon approach, and, you know, elevate some of the triceps. But, you know, this is going to be done with, you know, a lot of mini frag fixation, as well as some, I use like bioabsorbable pins and so forth for some of the articular fragments here, because this is just a shell of bone. So I'm trying to just to piece this together and then provide some type of, you know, buttress anteriorly there for the shear fragments. I mean, just trying to reconstitute this is, you know, as it was mentioned, there is some impaction as well. I try to disimpact, but in the elderly patient, I found that they, you know, I try to disimpact very, I said gingerly. You can make a problem worse, at least in my experience, and I don't have the experience as everybody on this panel. But I try to disimpact a little bit. I will use some bone graft when possible, or those, you know, sometimes bioabsorbable pins, just almost as a rafting pins or rafting screws. But I have seen if you try to disimpact this area that you actually can cause more damage and maybe what was kind of stable impaction, you know, like we see in other fractures, like say a femoral neck fracture, which I know is totally different, but, you know, impaction, it leads to stability in the pelvis and the femur. And some of this impaction can be, I think, well tolerated in low demand patients.
That's great. Jenny, how about you? He's going to do a posterior approach. Any opportunity for like that extensile lateral, sort of what you would do for a capitellar shear fracture? Are you going to do a posterior approach for this as well?
Yeah, I think I would lean towards an extensile lateral. I think what fortunately the fracture gave you, I think, is that the lateral epicondyle is broken. So you could utilize that, deliver the humerus, you know, out of the lateral incision and, you know, hopefully fix the distal humerus, the medial portion, and then reduce and then fix the lateral side as well. Yeah, so I'd probably favor extensile lateral. You know, I think in addition to bone grafting options, I think I maybe would consider having some sort of bone substitute option as well that provides a little bit more structural sort of time zero support that you could fix with independent screws and or threaded K wires. And then, you know, the other maybe question I have, if I'm allowed to ask questions, is, you know, I think a lot of, you know, Dr. Moore and Dr. Driscoll, you guys talk about, you know, having a two runner elbow. So, you know, the medial trochlea is intact. If the capitellum is repairable, reconstructable, does the central portion or lateral portion really matter? And in which case, can you sort of ignore that and hope that the, you know, the two runners on the medial lateral side heal and then gives her a functional outcome?
Showing a little more of a historical approach there, the kind of the two runner idea. I think Bernie talked some about that. What are your thoughts about that in this indication? And maybe what approach would you take if you were, let's say, in an austere environment, and you were going to fix this instead of replace it?
Yeah, and I was really glad, Jan, to hear you bring that up, and Jenny, for you then to bring it as a question. Because I had said, you know, that trochlea was impacted, that'll have to be disimpacted. It's not so simple to have said that it has to be disimpacted. I was referring to the fact that to restore the axis of rotation as one single axis across the whole distal humerus, it would have to be disimpacted. Doesn't mean that you can't get away with leaving it impacted where it is and having a two-runner elbow. So that's a really good option. The concept of a two-runner elbow would be that there's a section of joint on the medial side and a section of joint on the lateral side that are lined up, and you can be missing the part in the middle. Very important concept, and that is a way to get away with it. I'm not completely sure in this elbow whether that will work or not. I just don't know. The reason is that on the medial side, with that trochlea sloping upwards, if there is no lateral trochlea, then what will tend to happen on that medial runner is that the coronoid will tend to want to slide upwards into the humerus, into the gap. because it acts like a wedge. And so if it's inclined, then the coronoid is going to want to slide upwards. And that would tend to displace the elbow laterally again, the forearm that is laterally against the distal humerus. Now, if it was only minor, it wouldn't be an issue and you'd get away with a two-runner elbow. So no, going into this case, one would have to know that. So Jan knew that. Jenny knew that. I know that, John, you do. If one is familiar with that, that's one of those backup plans. And I mentioned before, if you can't fix it, what are your backup plans? So a backup plan is a two-runner elbow. And that indeed is a possibility here. So yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. It's not so simple as black and white decision-making here. And in terms of approach, if I was in an austere environment and I was going to fix this, I would go in with the full plan of fixing it. If that's the case, I would do an olecranon osteotomy and get the best view I possibly can and fix it that way. If there was the slightest chance that I was going to replace it rather than fix it, then I would do a diamond pop-up approach, which is really a triceps tongue, a modified triceps tongue approach. So you leave the olecranon bony part intact. You don't get quite as much exposure, but you get a really good exposure. And because that lateral condyle is fractured, then you can open up the elbow as a book as well. So that would give enough exposure for somebody comfortable fixing the distal humerus to do so.
I think that's great. And I too, Sean, would do an olecranon osteotomy with a plan for fixation. So I think we'd put that under sort of that triceps reflecting group. One of the things that I would advise people is when in the fractures like this, where you're worried about a posterior approach getting to the anterior aspect of the capitellum, in particular, when you do an osteotomy and the lateral epicondyle is off, you can get perfect sort of end-on view of the distal articular segment because the humerus sort of is able to be subluxated out of the elbow as well because the lateral epicondyle is off and you can get a really nice view of it. So that would sort of be my favorite approach too, but it looks like people were sort of split on lots of those options. So I think the viewers and listeners of the poll are divided a little bit too. And I think a lot of it comes down to, again, your comfort level with difficult fractures. And certainly you don't want to be taking on a difficult fracture with an approach that you're not used to. Jan,
so, you know, a lot of times in the trauma world, we're kind of, you know, we do osteotomies for a lot of things, especially around the, you know, including the elbow and so forth. But we're told, hey, if you want to get an arthroplasty done around the elbow, don't do an olecranon osteotomy. I mean, I that's been like ingrained to me, or at least a lot of my partners will say it. They're very hesitant to do it, and so I wonder what you folks think that do total elbows and so forth. What do you think about, you know, if this patient does get an olecranon osteotomy, goes on to fail, not infected or anything, just post traumatic arthritis? What are your options then?
I think a well done, I'll go first and then I'd welcome others' comments. But if you do I think you should do the approach to the elbow that gives you the best chance at having that be the only operation for that patient. So if you do an olecranon osteotomy and you fix it well, that's not going to dramatically compromise the total elbow arthroplasty that I would subsequently do. If it develops a non-union or otherwise, it's going to turn into a staged operation to get the olecranon fixed. But there are also available options to fix the olecranon around a total elbow arthroplasty. So I would not do an operation that leaves you with less visualization to hedge if she needs a total elbow arthroplasty down the road. I don't know if others have thoughts about that.
I agree, John. I agree absolutely. So if I knew I was doing a total elbow, I would do a total elbow approach. If I was planning to fix it, I would do a fixation approach. As I mentioned, if I thought there was a chance that I was going to switch from one to the other, I personally would do a diamond pop-up approach because I can get enough exposure through that, but it's not as much exposure as you get through olecranon osteotomy. So I would say that if it was someone who's not as familiar, do the very best approach, do an olecranon osteotomy. And if it has to be replaced, well, then we fix the olecranon. There are ways to do that. So an olecranon that's been cut is not a big problem if you convert to total elbow, or an olecranon that has failed to unite is also not a big problem. It's a problem, but it's not one of the bigger problems at all to then do a total elbow in that patient. It's a manageable problem.
All right, Jenny, next question. This is a little bit unique. We talked about, I think we're going to be a little more outside the box on this distal humerus because it's articular. And we talked about maybe threaded wires or otherwise. What's your fixation construct going to look like in terms of, let's say, outside the plate fixation and then plate fixation as well, if you're going to use that?
I don't recall on the CT scan whether or not the medial trochlea is still attached to the medial condy. I think that portion was intact. If that's the case, then I would probably favor independent buried screws or K-wires into those articular fragments, and then a single lateral plate to capture that lateral epicondyle. And then depending on screw traffic, try and send some screws across the joint too, although based on that coronal shear fracture, screws coming from a direct lateral plate might just be cutting right through the fracture plane. So I think really the purpose of that lateral plate is to hold that lateral epicondyle in place, especially, with the size of her arm.
Jan, what are your thoughts here? Where are you going to put your plates or your fixation? You talked about some, headless compression screws, or what is your thought here?
Yeah. So similar, I'm going to, potentially headless compression screws. I don't use buried K wires anymore. I'll use these just like bioabsorbable pins, which are basically K wires. But I use it for that, reason. I have seen sometimes like these collapse a little bit or develops, sometimes those smaller pieces develop AVN and then you have a prominent K wire. Unfortunately, I've had that happen. Then I would do some type of, lateral plate fixation. I'm a big fan of, once again, like mini frag screws or mini frag plates, for some of those smaller pieces, but I would back this up with the larger, lateral plate here.
And a direct lateral plate or posterior lateral?
Direct lateral.
Perfect. Sean, I've sort of maybe hopefully not drifted too far from the parallel plating, but here one of the things that I kind of like the idea of is a lateral plate and a posterior lateral plate, because that lateral column is needing support. Thoughts? How would you, I would do a posterior lateral and a direct lateral plate, and I would probably place screws into the intact medial trochlea through that from my lateral plate and not do a medial plate. What are your thoughts about plate construct here?
I think we must be thinking the same, John. quite the opposite of your concern. So this bone is osteopenic and it's thin, and the fracturing goes up into the condyle, which means that screws that come from back to front, which are the final screws you're going to need to put in there, probably will not be supported really. And so they need to go, if that's the case, they would need to go through a plate into the anterior bone to be supported. So a lateral plate for sure, because that permits screws to go across into the medial side. I would have one or two screws that I would place from the medial side across into the coronal fragments. Okay, so coming from a horizontal direction into those anterior fragments, and they would be interdigitating with screws I would then place through a lateral plate into the medial side. And the very end would be screws going from back to front into the fragments to lock it in three dimensions. Those last screws, if the bone is good on the condyle, can just be put through bone. But if not, should be put through a plate. And then the final thing is that I certainly would plan to use little tiny, like 0.035, 0.035 or 0.045 at most, threaded K wires to build the pieces together as little tiny, tiny dowels, but just to hold them aligned while you get the fixation in place. And then I was going to say, finally, I would consider a skinny wire technique for this. It might well be that skinny wire technique might be appropriate for it as well.
Perfect. So lots of good thoughts, tips, and tricks from experts there on open reduction internal fixation. Let's move now to arthroplasty. So Jenny, let's start with you. You were thinking maybe of leaning toward elbow arthroplasty. What are your thoughts about elbow arthroplasty? And I think the controversy here, and certainly it was an active controversy on each of the social media platforms, as well as the OrthoBullets platform. Thoughts about elbow hemiarthroplasty or total elbow arthroplasty? Certainly, granted, we have the caveats that we don't have an elbow hemiarthroplasty that's made for that in the United States. What are your thoughts here?
Yeah, I think that I often hear that we wish we had a real hemiarthroplasty here that could be utilized. So I think that would potentially be something that would be a benefit for her. So I think in terms of deciding hemi versus total for her will be really kind of discussing with her, again, her activity levels. I think people tend to not restrict hemis as they would totals. But of course, you know, depending on your soft tissue repair, you know, there is the risk of, you know, instability, perhaps with a hemiarthroplasty. So, I guess I would lean more towards total elbow arthroplasty, just I'm a little bit concerned about her soft tissue size, and the stress on that implant in terms of being able to maintain stability of that implant.
Yeah, so I think one of the articles we saw posted, this is not a point counterpoint, but this is part of the coin flip, is that there is level one randomized control trial data that says for difficult or unreconstructable elbow fractures, total elbow arthroplasty had better outcomes, and that those continued out to 12 and a half years. So we talked about the caveats of total elbow arthroplasty and fixation. Certainly, people should feel empowered to fix them. But I would also say that there is a suggestion in the literature for many of these fractures that total elbow arthroplasty works extremely well. And in fact, in well-trained hands may outperform open reduction internal fixation. Thoughts, Sean, about the general feelings about total elbow arthroplasty for fracture? And then maybe if you have comments as a designer of total elbow arthroplasties on elbow hemiarthroplasties and their current roles.
Yeah, I think that what you just said, John, summarizes it well, that a total elbow arthroplasty free of complication of infection or other serious complication is a very reliable procedure in an elderly patient. So without question, their function is really quite reliably restored. I think that their recovery is quicker and their function better than internal fixation. And I say that in the context of someone who earlier said that I try to fix all of them. Yeah. I think I have a low threshold for fixing them rather than replacing them. Or another way, I guess, would be to say I have a higher threshold for replacing. But having said that, hemiarthroplasty is an option for those who have it. It's not an option in the United States, but it is elsewhere. And that you're right, I was the designer, one of the three designers of the hemiarthroplasty and one of the total elbow systems, the Latitude, that we use. So in that regard, I have a potential conflict of interest. A hemi, although we would have thought might have had problems with instability in some patients, has turned out really to have a almost non-existent problem with instability. At least it hasn't been documented to be a complication in patients who've been operated on or reported. So it seems that the scarring process around the elbow, combined with the fact that you can put a heavy non-absorbable suture from the condyles on either side through the prosthesis at the axis of rotation, is enough to get the soft tissue sleeve to heal around the elbow. And whether or not you need bony union, I think hasn't been shown conclusively, but you need either bony union or soft tissue scarring around the elbow to keep that stability.
Yeah, there's a recent, or it's basically brand new, but it's ahead of print. There's a randomized control trial that will be fun to discuss with people. But they, Adolphson is writing it up, and it's just ahead of print right now. And they showed basically similar outcomes with hemi and total elbow arthroplasty in elderly patients with fractures. So that's emerging data. It'll be fun for us to follow. There is certainly in some of the American series of elbow hemiarthroplasties, a concern about ulnar subsidence over time or wear of the ulna in that construct. So Really great work being done in Sweden, and we'll look forward to following some of that data as we go forward. For now, in my opinion, I think I would lean toward total elbow arthroplasty. So here's the pictures of the total elbow arthroplasty. Jan, I don't mean to cut you out, but now you're less of a total elbow arthroplasty surgeon, so I'll let the arthroplasty surgeons criticize me. But here is the construct that I did. So I went with a longer stem on the humerus, and part of the reason or rationale for that was the size of her arm to decrease the loosening rate. And certainly in the setting of fracture, there's a little bit more concerns there. And these are her later follow-up x-rays, her AP and lateral. And I would make note that with this longer implant, I did modify the implant because there's a tendency for this component to want to come out the back. So I did do some modification of the implant. And at 2 years with Mayo elbow performance score, her function was very good. Thoughts or criticisms, Jenny or Sean, about implant choice, implant placement, and how you approach these patients?
Well, I think that this looks perfect, John. It's superb. It's perfectly aligned. You can see anatomic alignment of the radial head with the capitellar component of the distal humerus. And that, by the way, maybe is worth a comment for those who are not as familiar. That's not readily achieved if you're not familiar with the fact that the ulnar component must be seated in what looks like a relatively lateral position in the ulna. If you look at that ulna, there's more coronoid medially than there is laterally. And Dr. Barlow understands that. And so getting the insertion point correct in the ulna is necessary in order to not inadvertently translate the whole forearm laterally and have the radial head articulating against the capitellum on the edge of the radial head. That unfortunately can lead to painful arthritis and necessitate removal of the radial head later. So I think this is a perfectly done total elbow. As for whether or not to use a long humeral component and a long flange versus a shorter one, I think we don't know. We used to routinely use a long one with the Coonrad Mori. When I trained, that was the only one we ever used. There wasn't even a short one. And over time, we moved more and more towards using a shorter component in the range of 100 millimeters or 4 inches instead of 6 inches or 150 millimeters. This is a 150 component, I can tell. Given that it'll probably never have to have another operation, it's fine. If it does have to come out for infection reasons, it is hard to get the cement out way up there. And that's the only real advantage of using a shorter humeral component, is getting the cement out.
Jenny, thoughts about tips or techniques? I did a triceps on lateral paratricipital approach here. Thoughts about getting this right, this operation right?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I've learned is that rotation of those components is really key. So both in the ulna and also on the humeral side. And then as Dr. O'Driscoll already mentioned, you know, making sure that at least your ulnar component, that the starting point is a lot more radial. But I think I still take my time with these because I perseverate over the rotation a lot. But so I think a lateral paratricipital approach can be helpful with that. I've tried doing these through a paratricipital approach, which I think ultimately makes it much more challenging to instrument the ulna well. The other thing which we didn't really talk about too much is how you actually, what position you would do the total elbow in. I think with my trauma training, sometimes for patients, I will go in thinking I might be able to fix it, but have arthroplasty available to bail. But, you know, for my fixations, I do these in a lateral position. And I've found that trying to do an arthroplasty well in a lateral position is very challenging. Again, particularly to try and get the rotation right. The other things, you know, that we talk about in terms of avoiding impingement is you do have to take some part of the coronoid tip off so that in flexion that you don't get impingement of that bone on the humeral component. I think other technical pearls that I've learned from you guys is the olecranon fossa posteriorly, taking a burr and really removing that piece of bone so that you're not extending the stem as you go in and accidentally perforating. I use fluoro for a lot of these to make sure that my components are well positioned. Again, just because I don't do these in high enough volume to trust my intraoperative assessment that my components are going in correctly.
And I would say very few people have enough volume of these to say, oh, I know exactly where that's going to be. So you should have no dorsally is difficult. And in particular, one complication I have had is if I thinned the olecranon too much at the triceps on approach, I had a olecranon fracture postoperatively in one of my patients. Thoughts about how to walk that line appropriately, or maybe it's just kind of a feel thing. What are your thoughts about how to get that alignment right?
Yeah, that's a very wise point to raise, John. And I think the risk of a fracture is greater with the triceps on for a number of reasons. One is that we have to think about this olecranon, and I confess I didn't think about it this way for a number of years until I learned the hard way. We have to think about it as a three-dimensional structure that has strength due to the shape of its outer surfaces. And one of those outer surfaces is the articular surface in here between the ulna and the humerus. So when we cut into that articular surface and remove the subchondral bone, we've essentially converted something that is a three-dimensional structure to a partial three-dimensional structure, and it's weakened. It's weakened substantially. So if the triceps is pulling on it during surgery, there's a much greater risk of fracture, and there's a risk of post-op fatigue fracture too. So I would say there are a couple of things. One is minimize the amount of bone that you remove from the ulna, and that's done by using the bell saw that is one size smaller than the size of the implant that you're putting in. So if you're putting in this, let's say this was a medium implant, I don't know what size it is, but let's say it was a medium, then you would want to cut the ulna with the small bell saw. So that's one thing. The second is that when you make a little burr hole into the canal, notch down, I think I'll use my my marking device here again, notch down into this area here a little bit with your burr. So you want to make sure that you make an opening, but you don't have a straight line from that opening down towards the cortex like that. Instead, you take some bone out from below here so you can slip in a direction that is a little bit more like this down into the canal. I'm sorry, it's not a very very straight line there. And then finally, if you're having difficulty with that, if there's any resistance at all to the, let's see, I want to get rid of that, don't I? If there's any difficulty at all in getting down to the canal, then you should do this in two separate steps. So ream with the flexible reamers down into the canal. You've already cut the ulna. Ream with the flexible reamers down into the canal. And then use the device off the Kunrad Mori set called the GSB rasp to go from this region here down into the canal to meet where you have reamed, rather than trying to force your way down into the canal and maybe point towards that posterior cortex there. So it's a number of techniques combined that can allow you to do that fairly safely. And if you have a deformity such that there is no way to put the prosthesis in, then as John mentioned earlier, we have found sometimes that we need to modify prostheses in order for them to fit the canal properly.
Well, team, I can't thank each of you enough for your expertise. Really nice insight into a challenging problem. And I think one of the highlights that I will take out of this is there's not one right answer for this. And I think even in 2023, we're going to rely on what works well in our hands and a thoughtful approach to it to avoid and mitigate complications, but also to maximize outcomes for these patients. Any additional thoughts that you guys have about this case before we go? Otherwise, thank you very much to the Ortho Bullets group for hosting this. And certainly, again, lots of conversation like this, both in a group setting and in a one-to-one setting, which with each of the Mayo faculty at the Comprehensive Shoulder and Elbow Current Concepts and Controversies Course 2024. Scottsdale, Arizona, January 25th to 27th. Thank you each again for coming. And thank you again, Ortho Bullets, for just an outstanding platform and outstanding hosting and all you do for residents and faculty.